And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Literary icon Ernest Hemingway once wrote of Kansas City that it was a strange and wonderful place, a place where the food is good, a place where the people spoke the purest American, and a place where, frankly, some years later, he found pretty dull. It takes a writer to present such a charming juxtaposition of place and space, and we're about to talk to writers who are part of a program called Working Words, a literary event coming to First Friday in the Crossroads, not too far from where Hemingway plied his trade at the Kansas City Star. This inaugural event is a collaboration between graduate students and creative writing programs at UMKC and at KU. Our guests are Andrew Johnson, not the president during Reconstruction, but the modern-day master in fine arts student here at UMKC, and Damon Haybrook, the gallery owner of the Beggar's Table in the Crossroads, where the Working Words event will be held this Friday evening. Tell us about the event, Damon.
Actually, I'd love to hear Andrew's thoughts on it.
Let's hear Andrew, President Andrew Johnson.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Thank you for coming, first of all, and tell us about the event.
So Working Words has traditionally been an event by the graduate students in creative writing at UMKC, where several times a year we get together to hear each other's work. Writing can be a pretty solitary act, and then in the classroom we're obviously hearing and critiquing each other's work. But Working Words is a great chance for us to hear each other's stories and poems and essays, just as a chance to hear them. So we've done this for several years, mostly just with each other, with our own crowd, and occasionally inviting people from other schools. So we thought this time we would move into the Crossroads and try to get more than just our own small crowd to come join us and hear our stories and be in a space with some art. So
move the golf clap of literary readings into the Crossroads. Speaking of which, what does adding a literary element to visual arts character First Friday do for the community, in your estimation, Damon Haybrock?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really intrigued to see how it's going to play. We've tried a couple of different events, but it's easy to have music along with a gallery show or other things of that sort, but to be able to have people in doing readings while others are engaged and invested. The great thing about the Crossroads, people are usually up for anything. So I think it should be a lot of fun. I think this show, the title of the show is Dwelling, and I asked 14 different artists to give a piece just based on that word. I just said, the words dwell or dwelling, give me something based on that. And I feel like being in the gallery, dwelling, listening to the words as you're watching the art, it should be a really interesting experience.
Andrew Johnson, what's unique about the literary community here in the KC metro area? You mentioned writing as a solitary exercise, which it is, but writers love to get among other writers and complain about being writers, among other things. So what's the literary community like?
It's actually very strong here in Kansas City. And, one of the reasons we're wanting to do this is to let the rest of Kansas City know that we do have a really strong writing community. We have award-winning writers, not only that we're familiar with at the Star, but also at UMKC and KU. But a lot of times, like you said, we're talking to each other, and we would like, just as visual artists have done over the last 10 years in the Crossroads, we'd like to let our local audience know that we're here.
How did you select this collection of writers for this event?
Right. So we've done these exchanges before with other MFA programs where we invite MU students or KU students to come and give a reading for us. So this time we sent some emails to the KU students and just said, we're going to put on this event and we'd love for you to come and write. And we got great response. We have 8 writers, fiction writers, poets, and nonfiction writers who are going to come and join us.
Have you ever invited MU and KU students at the same time?
No, we've not. That sounds like a great future Working Words event.
How does this group of writers, what do they have in common other than getting an MFA? What do they have in common and what makes them different?
I definitely focus on the differences. We have, I know among our UMKC students and just by the bios of the KU students, there's a lot of variety, not only in genre of what they write, but topics. We have someone who apparently is interested in writing about avocados tonight and someone who is interested in writing about the surlier side of the Midwest. So there's variety, but I would say what holds them together and holds a lot of us graduate students together is language. And as you said in the intro, language being art and us being able to define and explore the human experience through language.
Speaking of the surlier side of the Midwest, joining us right now is Sarah Levins. Just to give you a little background on Sarah Levin, she's a first-year Master of Fine Arts student at KU, and she claims to speak poet, just in case people need a translation. She's a fiction writer and also an avid connoisseur of cardigan sweaters.
I am.
You are. Are you wearing a cardigan sweater right now?
I actually am, yes. Unironically, I am wearing a cardigan sweater. It's cold in my apartment. So.
Do you have anything with elbow pads?
No, I don't. I haven't ventured into that arena yet. But I do have houndstooth. That was my most recent purchase.
Houndstooth is a good look. What do you mean when you say the surlier side of the Midwest? Midwest.
Yeah, definitely. As you'll see from the piece that I'm reading, my main character, Carl Francis, is a little bit grumpier. He's not quite that apple pie type of Midwestern that people generally tend to think of. He's a little bit darker, and I'm more interested in that. I think it's the trend, to talk about the coast, and I think it's time to talk about the Midwest and talk about us as real people. You know, we're not all completely nice. You know, some of us are angry, some of us are grumpy, some of us are surly. We're real people, and that's what I try to depict in my writing.
Well, tell us what you're about to read from. Give us a little background on it. What's the title?
Well, this is a story called Waking Limb, and it's about a 50-year-old factory worker named Carl Francis on a very special day in his life. The piece starts out talking about his routine, and then it ends with an explanation of why this day is just so special for him.
Well, take us away with an excerpt from Waking Limb with the main character, Carl Francis. This is Sarah Levin's.
Okay.
Take us away.
Waking Limb. Between 4:30 and 4:45 a.m., Monday through Friday, Carl Francis prepares for his entry into the world of the waking by performing a regimented routine of calisthenics, binge coffee drinking, and what he believes is Tai Chi. It is a process he has been perfecting over the course of 30 years. He is the master of this 15-minute universe. At 4:47, he ties on his boots, sturdy oxblood Red Wings, locking them tightly to his ankles through tarnished brass half buckles. To make sure they won't budge, he turns his ankles downward and spanks the steel toes against the marbled carpet lining the entryway of the 3-bedroom ranch on Willow Street. Secured in his uniform, he takes the remaining minutes before his 4:50 departure for the factory, where he spends 8 hours operating a machine that drills holes in parts for John Deere tractors, to fill his thermos with the rest of the coffee from the percolator and stare at the fading stars in the infant morning sky. His commute is a 30-minute eastbound drive towards the Mississippi through pockets of river valley fog, fighting desperately to hang on in the midst of heat from the rising sun. He listens to NPR on his drive as a means of connecting with his 27-year-old daughter and her dirty-haired husband, Evan, the currently unemployed environmentalist/artist from Chicago. Paul has always liked hippie types. It was his idea to name his daughter Janice. But his son-in-law seems different, like a bad politician faking it for the approval rating. Evan didn't even know what Woodstock was before Carl made him listen to the quadruple disc collection 3 months earlier. Evan chastises Carl for the week in December he spends hunting deer, his refusal to take tote bags to the grocery store, and his gas hog pickup, neglecting to remember the monthly check that keeps him from being evicted. With the sounds of some Mongolian throat singer or Afro-Cuban calypso band providing a backdrop, the first fragments of filtered morning sunlight illuminate the craggy bluff faces, switchback roads, and slanted cornfields of northeast Iowa. Born and raised a few hundred miles away in the steamrolled flatlands that comprise the central part of the state, Carl still feels like a 6-year-old boy on Christmas morning when he lays eyes on this scenery, energized and awestruck. It is the best part of his day. Once he arrives at work, Carl will stand at his machine and pretend like he's never thought about how a bullet tastes when it slides through the soft palate before lodging itself in your brain. countless hours of watching drill bit meet sheet metal, wash, rinse, repeat. This is what paid for Janice's college education, the bottles of cheap vodka and dime bags, the bachelor's degree in technical communication, and the master's degree in something called rhetoric and organizational culture. This is what paid for that ludicrous wedding at an organic farm outside of Iowa City, the absolute insult of a photo taken of the happy couple inside an ancient piece of international harvester machinery because it was vintage and represented true American values. With no chance of retirement in sight, it is likely that Carl will work until the chemicals from his machine's coolant have completely corroded his hands, exposing the muscles and sinews under his skin. Carl Francis will work with his skinless hands until he drops dead at his machine, standing upright with those red wings still secured at his ankles, a shackled slave to honest hard work until his final breath. Carl Francis will not die today, though. Today, he will become a grandfather. That's it.
That's from a story called Waking Limb, where the main character is Carl Francis, who apparently listens to NPR as he goes to work at a John Deere factory, written eloquently by Sarah Levins, a first-year MFA student at KU who likes cardigan sweaters and claims to speak poet just in case people need a translation. Where did you come up with the idea for that story there, Sarah?
Well, my father has worked in factories for the past 40 years, and specifically the same factory for 25. Tai Chi and morning calisthenics was something that I observed on accident one morning. He was just on autopilot and attempting what he thought was Tai Chi. So I asked him just what he was doing, and he explained it to me. So, yeah, my dad also loved World Cafe.
And you got the dirty-haired son-in-law, too, to boot.
Yes, to boot. It is a fiction story, but Carl is very much my father.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. We've just heard from Sarah Levins, a first-year MFA student at KU who claims to speak poet and loves cardigan sweaters. Our other guest is Andrew Johnson, not the president during Reconstruction, but the modern-day Master of Fine Arts student at UMKC. Damon Haybrock, the gallery owner of Beggar's Table in the Crossroads, is all here. And we're all discussing the program called Working Words, a literary event coming to First Friday in the Crossroads, not too far from where Hemingway plied his trade. This inaugural event is a collaboration between graduate students in creative writing programs at UMKC and KU. Again, it's Friday, November 2nd at the Baker's Table Gallery at 2010 Baltimore in the Crossroads Arts District. We now have Justin Zaruba on the phone with us. He's another one of the MFA students from KU. And the most well-received of his work so far is a series of love poems between dinosaurs, a little bit of Paleolithic romance. Huh, Justin?
That's correct. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm great. You called me sir. You make me feel very old, but go ahead and tell me about your love poems among dinosaurs.
That was an exercise that I was assigned in my undergrad program, where we had to write a love poem, and that was the only requirement. And that was really treading into the area of poetry that I hate the most. And so I turned it into the complete opposite of what I think that they were expecting. And so I wrote love poems between dinosaurs as the asteroid is falling to wipe them out.
Wow.
And then it actually got published, and everybody seemed to really love it. So I realized that turning something on its head like that is can really open doors to creative ideas. And so that's really the approach I've taken with poetry since then.
And so do you find that your sarcastic angst is effective?
Well, I don't know if I would call it sarcastic angst. But yeah, I mean, it is very effective. I get to put my own creative spin on it, and results in poetry that's somewhat refreshing and new. At least I would hope that it would be regarded that way.
Well, you know, Justin, I can see you sitting there saying, you know what, I'm going to write about dinosaurs and love, see how that hits them.
You're right, yeah. I'm just scribbling my pen, like tearing through the paper. I'm so angry.
Right. What are you about to read for us right now?
What's that?
What are you about to read for us? You brought something to read for us?
Yeah, I'm I'm currently working on a collection of poems, but I have a select one or two, I guess, depending on how long you want me to read. But a couple poems here that are it's coming from a book that I'm writing that is centered around the idea of things that we don't know, and all the different. And when I say we, I mean humanity, I suppose. Everything that I can think of that we might not know, or is I'm writing a poem about all the different examples of those things.
Okay, well, let's go with it.
All right. This first poem is called The Space Between Us. You asked me once, if I don't believe aliens exist, then how do I explain the time you were out in a field, scarf wrapped around your neck, up so high it covered your mouth, with your hands tucked into your armpits, staring up at space, and you saw what you thought was a star, but it zigged this way and zagged this other way, and you slashed the space between us with your pointed finger in ways that planes and asteroids simply cannot move, and then it broke into five glowing orbs and made a shape like a star, spun all around before vanishing. You asked me, how do I explain that? You asked me, how do I explain those Egyptian pyramids? Giant sandstone miracles of geometry, so perfect that mankind could not have built them. They're so big, you said. And even if we wanted to, we could not build pyramids like that today. With all the machines, cranes, and bulldozers, and computers, we simply could not do it. So how did the Egyptians do it? And I said, we probably could do it, if we needed to. I don't think it's that hard to build a pyramid. But you insisted. Aliens came down. After venturing across the never-ending cold space, landed just outside of Cairo, and then did it for us. And I asked, why would they do that? And you said, every 3,000 years, these peaks of those pyramids would point to Sirius and Nairobi and the stars of Orion's belt. And I asked you why, and you admitted you did not know. And that makes two of us.
That was The Space Between Us, a poem written by Justin Zaruba, who's currently an MFA student at KU. The most well-received of his work so far was a series of love poems between dinosaurs, but based on what we just heard, he might have some legs for something else.
It ventures from topic to topic. That's certainly true.
Certainly, certainly. This is a collection of things that we don't know, which is the overlying theme of your poetry. What do you have up for us next? I think you've earned a second go-round there, Justin.
Thank you. The second poem is a poem that I wrote about my father's best friend, who I am therefore friends because I'm obviously just through transitive friendships. And he has been diagnosed with cancer, and I wanted to honor him in my own special way. So I have a poem about him and for him.
What is this piece called?
It is titled Short Range Prosecutor.
Short Range Prosecutor.
Yes.
Let's go ahead.
Short-range prosecutor, Bob, a friend of my father's, whose name truly is Bob, wore an eye patch most of his life to cover the eternally closed lid which covered the vacant socket. That's how I remember him from when I was a kid, an eye-patched, smiling man who lived on a Kansas farm, who smoked, who held me when I was a baby. And I remember when Bob laughed at something I said, not because I was a precocious child, but because I made a witty observation about the economy, the same economy that moved my father to Arizona. When Bob laughed, I knew then that I was an adult. My father, now a resident voter in Maricopa County, would venture back to Kansas to visit my niece and nephews, and I, a diligent, distant college student, would join him. And after scruffing the hair of tow-headed nephews, and after monster-chasing a screaming niece through my brother's living room, some time would be set aside to see Bob. Bob, now long given up on the eye patch, thin and pale, balding. And I would almost say he was always bald, but my memories are limited to that of the eye patch and his smile. He sat at a picnic table for the better half of 5 minutes before he was tired and ventured back to his living room with his brand new recliner. When it was time to go, I joked about my long ride home, that I would make great time if I went 160, and he didn't laugh. So I told him I would see him at Thanksgiving and Christmas and New Year's, and he said, let's hope so. Driving away, I asked my father how Bob lost his eye, and he told me he was in the Coast Guard and they hit a reef or something, and he was standing on the deck, and he fell and hit his face on a gun embankment thing. And I said, that must have been some time ago. And he said he was probably 19 or 20, and we might as well have been talking about the carving of the Sphinx for as long ago as that sounded right then.
That was Justin Zaruba. Short Range Prosecutor was the name of the poem. He's currently a Master's of Fine Arts student at KU, and he'll be reading tomorrow at a program called Working Words, a literary event coming the first Friday in the Crossroads at the Beggar's Table Gallery at 2010 Baltimore Avenue. We have with us in the studio Andrew Johnson, an MFA student at UMKC, and the owner of the Beggar's Table Gallery, Damon Haybrock. Damon, talk about the intersection of visual art and literary art and what it brings to a gallery setting and why you decided to combine these two arts.
Absolutely. The space that we have is actually, it's a church and gallery. So it's where our church meets on Sunday mornings, is in the gallery. And so we're already living in this tension, which is great. I mean, people come on first Fridays and they ask, where's the church? And right here.
People come on Sundays and ask, where's where, the
church? Yeah, exactly. You know, so the art gets to serve almost as our stained glass windows. Every 2 months, it changes the way that we feel, the way that we gather together as a community. And so we're already kind of diving into that in terms of the conversations that we have on Sundays and on Fridays and throughout the week. And so part of our conversations around this idea of a responsible, seamless faith, everything matters. And the language is so important to us, and we just kind of throw it around. And so I think there's really part of reclaiming that in the same way, for instance, with art. I feel like the church kind of discarded art for a couple hundred years, whereas it used to be one of the biggest supporters, creators of art in the world. And so to re-engage that, it's wild to me that so many people that we know from church backgrounds are blown away that we have anything to do with art. And I think at the same time as you're restoring that, the literature plays right in.
You're right. Some of the greatest art pieces in the Western world go back to the Renaissance period.
Absolutely.
Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the like, all commissioned by the Catholic Church. I think sometimes we forget that.
Yeah, we do.
That's an interesting concept going forward. Andrew Johnson, this is a very erotesic, I'm going to make that word up, erotesic question for you. Esoteric is the correct word. But why did you want to become a writer?
Why did I want to become a writer? It's something that post-college, after working in a few jobs, I came to realize it was something that ever since childhood I enjoyed doing and that I was good at. I remember, you know, writing little songs when I was 10 years old, little imitation pop songs, and that grew into journaling and grew into poetry writing. And so eventually realized it's what I enjoy doing, it's what I'm good at, and if it's something I can contribute in a meaningful way in spaces such as this, then I want to do that.
This just in from UrbanDictionary.com, erotesic is actually when you're flying through the air with swagger. Arrow, that, A-E-R-O.
You can apply that word to me anytime. That sounds awesome.
Boom. Boom. So what do you think the community at First Friday will get out of a literary approach in an art gallery?
You know, I think it'll be a great experiment. It's going to be interesting to share space with visual art and literary art. I hope people can come and whether they're coming to see the art and they get roped in by one of Sarah's or Justin's stories or poems, or if they come for the reading and they get caught by one of the pieces on the wall, we hope that people can come and enjoy sharing that space together and learn and listen to each other.
Who do you enjoy? Who are your literary idols that you look up to?
Sure. I'm mostly a nonfiction writer. So Annie Dillard, Brian Doyle, some lesser-known ones, but then George Saunders is kind of a more well-known New Yorker-type writer. Those are the ones I enjoy.
And what are you working on right now, yourself?
Right now I'm working on my thesis that I'll be wrapping up next May. It's interdisciplinary, so I'm doing both poetry and nonfiction. So it'll be about 140 pages, collection of essays, short micro-essays, and then also a 40-page chapbook of poetry.
Do you have a stated position?
A stated position?
Of your thesis.
Of my thesis.
What's the overall premise?
You know, I'm really interested in what a lot of essays call the quotidian, just the everyday, normal little things of life, and just paying attention to those, seeing how we can get some meaning out of them, get some interesting language out of them.
We're just talking to Andrew Johnson and giving him a little live radio thesis committee here on Central Standard. Andrew Johnson is a Master of Fine Arts student at UMKC. We also want to thank Justin Zaruba and Sarah Levins, both respectively MFA students at KU, for reading their work here on live radio. And we also have the owner of the Beggar's Table in the Crossroads, Damon Haybrock. That's a gallery where an event called Working Words, a literary event at First Friday in the Crossroads, November 2nd. The gallery is at 2010 Baltimore Avenue in the Crossroads Arts District. Gentlemen, thank you for coming.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, executive produced by Bill Anderson. Kim Noble is our announcer, and Emily Mutert manages our website. Central Standard's intro theme music is by Miles Bonney, and the outro that you're hearing right now is composed by the Will Knots of Lawrence, Kansas. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.